You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Feel like who Art Ed?
I'm trying to spice it.
Who Art Ed? Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's obviously a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, weekly art history for all ages. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and today we're going to be talking about Eve Klein. And I am very excited because my guest today is a fellow art teacher and someone who I have considered to be a sort of distant mentor, even though he's been unaware of it, because I have been listening to him and reading articles for years. Welcome once again, Tim Bogads from Art Ed Radio and the Art of Education University.
Well, thank you, Kyle. I am super excited to be back on the show. When you reached out and said, oh, let's talk about Eve Klein, I was like, yes, we need to. I don't know. You and I were talking off air just a bit ago about how there's not a ton of work to talk about, but yet I still think he's made some incredible stuff and was actually pretty influential. So hopefully we can make this an interesting one. But thanks for the invite once again. And like I said, I'm thrilled to be back here.
And I'm happy to have you as always. And so now to get into it, as you said, Eve Klein had sort of a short but very memorable life and career. He was born April 2nd, 1928 in Nice, France. His parents were both artists. His mother, Marie, was part of the Art Informal movement. And I feel like this is a good time. Are you familiar with the Art Informal movement? Because that was one like I had to look it up.
So last week when I was doing a little bit of research for this episode, it was literally the first time I had heard of that. So I'll just go ahead and say, no, I'm not familiar.
Yeah. So it's one of those obviously smaller movements of art history that it's not front of mind. I recognized the term, but could not have defined it at the time.
Couldn't tell you anything about it.
But basically, the Art Informal movement was part of that. I lump it in with like surrealism and Dada, that sort of against the rational composition and those traditional formal aesthetics. It was very experimental. And I feel like that very perfectly foreshadows what we're going to get into throughout this story. His father was also an artist. Fred Klein was a post-impressionist painter, which I think most of us are much more familiar with.
I was going to say much more traditional.
Yeah. So interestingly, I guess I got to say which Klein, because I was going to say Klein, Eve Klein studied a lot of things and not just art. In fact, his first passion was not the visual arts. His first passion was judo.
Yes, this is like my favorite fact about him, because not only did he love judo, he was really, really good at judo. I think he got to like fourth level black belt, like a literal international master. Like he studied in Japan and was like, I don't know if we want to say a worldwide phenomenon, but he was very well known for his judo skill, which I just love.
Correct. He was a fourth degree black belt, studied it in Japan, and I believe he was the first European to earn that distinction of fourth degree black belt.
Nice.
And he wrote a book about it, taught other people judo. Like he was all in on that as sort of his first career. He had other passions for, you know, jazz, of course, in the early to mid 20th century. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like every artist, loved to read literature. And I guess he was also into Eastern religions, which kind of makes sense. There was always a little bit of like a mysticism about him. And I've read that related to his judo, he sort of built some mythology around himself, claiming he could levitate and had learned all these other things that, you know, the rules of gravity did not apply to him after he had attained that fourth degree or fourth level of black belt and stuff like that, which I always love someone who is willing to just make an absurd boast.
Why not? You know, like you said, it's all about just sort of building the mythology around it. And then, you know, once you have that established, then you can really get away with anything as an artist, which I'm sure we'll talk about here.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of the reading that I was reading this stuff, speaking of mythology, I came across all of these stories from interviews and things that had been passed down that I'm just like, I'm not sure I entirely believe this, but, you know, like, as someone of Irish descent, I'm not going to let the truth get in the way of a good story. And one of those great origin stories is, he says, growing up, you know, he was obviously, his parents were artistically inclined, but so were his friends. And so he said one day he's at the beach in Nice, and he and his friends, Claude Pascal, a poet, and Armand Fernandez, another visual artist, decided to divide up the universe amongst themselves. Claude claimed language, Armand, the animal realm, and Eve took the sky, saying, "The blue sky is my first artwork," which, again, I feel like that is something, you know, that came about much later in his career, but it's just such a perfect story.
It is.
You know, I want it to be true.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You do, because that's something that just sort of was a through line for his entire career. Just the idea of the color blue, obviously, but also just this idea of infinity, you know, just like these things going on forever. And, you know, a lot of times you see that where, you know, he'll come up with a painting or a sculpture and it's like the blue is all there is. And so, you know, the idea of, you know, the sky being an artwork, you know, really resonates. And like you said, sort of sets up the story for a lot of his later work.
Yeah. And I guess in 1949, he moves to London, and that he apprenticed at a frame shop. And that's where he starts to get acquainted with like pure pigments, including gold leaf. I didn't realize this because like my art history survey courses and stuff way back in the day, you know, you read the paragraph about Eve Klein and it's just like international Klein blue. He did lots of monochromes.
Yeah, lots of monochromes. And like you said, he loved his gold. I have a story about gold later on that I want to tell, but yeah, he loved his blue, obviously, but also gold and also other monochromes.
Okay, I just gotta say, you can't throw out that you've got a great story and not share it.
I promise it'll come later. We need to talk when he gets more into his conceptual stuff, and I'll share the story about what he did with his gold.
Okay, so we've got a nice teaser for something coming up, but he starts experimenting with pure pigments, and I have read that actually, like, this work with pure pigments, because as you and I both know, when you're working with pure pigments, sometimes there are not so healthy chemicals involved in them.
For sure.
That may have contributed to his early death, because he passed away, sadly, just in his mid-30s. But back to the part where he's still alive. The late 1940s and 50s, he's working on monochrome paintings. Mono, of course, meaning one, and chroma meaning color. So it's all just one color, like which I feel like so many people were doing that in that day. You know what I'm saying? Like,
mm-hmm.
it was Eve Klein. It was Robert Rauschenberg. It was, you know, like how many different stances on there can you have on a monochrome? But yeah, he did it. Sure. His big ones were the blue. He also did a lot with pink and gold, as we've mm-hmm. already alluded mm-hmm. to. But he didn't just stop there. Like, he liked to experiment, and he actually worked with a chemist, Edward Adam. I'm sure it's like Edward Adam or something like that. But they developed, as we've said, International Klein Blue. It's his trademark color, literally trademarked in 1957. And basically, yeah. It's just this super saturated blue.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we just appreciate the brilliance of just like creating your own color and trademarking it? Like, it's incredible to me that he would think to do that. And like you said, it's not just any color. It is like this. It's so rich and it's so beautiful. I don't know if you've ever seen International Klein Blue in person, yeah. But it's just gorgeous. Like, you know, it pops off the page in your art history book, but then when you see it in real life, you're like, this might be the most beautiful color I've ever seen. Like, it's absolutely incredible. And yeah, I just have a lot of respect for him for just thinking to create his own color and then trademark it. I think that's brilliant.
See, I'm conflicted on that because in all honesty, like, I love a good blue. I've seen Yves Klein blue in person mm-hmm. and nothing compares to the in-person. It's one of those things that just the reproduction cannot capture it, because literally you cannot get this blue anywhere else.
Right. Right.
But and I love a good blue. I absolutely love a good blue. I feel a little conflicted, though, because I feel like it's a little bit of like the Stuart Semple, Anish Kapoor kind of thing.
Yes.
Where it's like, I hate the idea of a color being walled off and blocking others from using something. I feel mm-hmm. like developing your own blue, hats off to you, even though it's, let's face it, it's basically ultramarine, you know,
right. Like,
but, you know, he got something with these synthetic polymers to get it this ultra matte, which helps with the saturation and mm-hmm. all of that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I respect that. I wish it hadn't been, you know, well, this is my color and you can't have it, you know.
Fair.
And the history of blue is actually something that I have always found really just absolutely fascinating, with the idea that, you know, ultramarine used to be more valuable than gold because.
Yeah, I was going to say it used to be like super valuable, right?
Yeah, because it came from the lapis lazuli stones, which, like, you already think, OK, we got to take these stones, grind them into dust. Yeah, I could see where that's a bit of a pain, but that's mm-hmm. actually the easy part, because they exclusively for a long time were getting them from like remote mountainous regions in Afghanistan. So then they had to get them, then crush them, and then it had to be like, it went through like, I think, three different filtering processes, because 97% of it, of the stone, was not usable pigment. And so, like, it's just this incredibly labor-intensive process to develop it. And so, actually, the country of France had a contest. They offered a prize of, I think it was 6,000 francs in the mid-19th century for somebody who could create a synthetic ultramarine pigment. Mm. And that's where we get our Prussian blue. I think it was Prussian blue that came from that.
It was. I actually just learned about this not that long ago. A non-art friend was telling me about like the history of Prussian blue, and it was the first like synthetic blue pigment. I was like, I had no idea. Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah. And that's why, like, if you look back in the Renaissance, you know, artists actually would have in their contract how much ultramarine would be used and where. And so, like, it was only on sacred subjects, like, Mary would have her cloth be ultramarine and stuff like that as sort of that devotional thing, you know? And so to bring this whole thing full circle, Klein actually would talk about how he saw blue as sacred. You know, he talked about claiming the sky, but he also saw the blue, gold, and rose as symbolic of sort of a holy trinity. And so going on, you know, like I said, he created his own blue. He loved a good spectacle. You know, there's that famous stunt with the humans covered in paint as living brushes, creating work by pressing themselves against the canvas.
Well, and he turned those into live performances, too. So like a lot of, you know, people would consider him sort of a forefather of performance art and things like that. Cause yeah, he would have his models in blue paint and he would literally like drag them around the canvas to create, I think they're called anthropometries. But then, yeah, he would have like an entire symphony there and just playing real weird music. There's one symphony played during one of these performances that was a 20-minute long note, just a single note for 20 minutes. Followed by 20 minutes of silence. And that was the entire performance while these people covered in paint are being dragged around on canvases to create the paintings. And so, yeah, like you said, it was a spectacle.
Yeah. And I feel like in some ways this is like that era where people started to look at the fine arts world and say like, what is with these people?
Yeah, like I'm not sure about these people.
And I think my favorite example of this, where he's really pushing boundaries, was 1958. He held an exhibition called The Specialization of Sensibility, and it was just a blank-walled, empty gallery. And he had a line going down the block. He welcomed people in like 10 at a time just to see an empty space. And then just to take it to an absurd level that shows like he was doing more than just a little prank, you know, showing them an empty space. He also served them drinks that were specifically formulated so that it would make their urine come out ultramarine blue.
Oh no. I had not heard of that before.
Yes.
That's incredible. Okay, but the empty gallery does give me a good segue into my gold story, because not only did he do this empty gallery as an exhibit, he later went on to sell invisible paintings. He would sell empty space as his artwork. And so he would, line up the buyer. And he would insist that they pay in gold. Okay? And so they would have to get, you know, nuggets of gold, chunks of gold. I don't deal with gold. I don't know how it comes. But they would bring the gold, and then he would write out like a certificate of ownership. And they would meet by the Seine River. And then they would give him the gold. He would give them the certificate of ownership for this non-existent painting, for this invisible painting. And they would hand him the gold. He would hand them the check or the paper. And then he would insist that they burn their certificate of ownership. And then as it's being burned, he would take the gold and throw it into the river. Okay? Oh, and so they exchanged everything. But then 30 seconds later, there's no proof that they've ever owned this invisible painting. It just fascinating to me that A, people would go for that. And B, that, he just decided to throw gold into the river because he didn't really want it, I guess.
Wow. Now, on a related note, just a fun fact that reminded me, are you aware that there is a museum of non-visible art?
No, I have never heard of this.
Yes, some artists created a museum of non-visible art in New York. And it's just,
oh my word.
It just has like title cards for you to imagine
what's there.
See, yeah.
I'm not even sure if I would go to that. I don't know.
But it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, 70 years later, we're all rehashing Eve Klein's.
I'm just way ahead of his time.
Yeah. And so I guess after the break, I want to always talk about a specific work. And I think there is one piece we've been kind of alluding to, some of the stuff around the margins. If you went way back, we actually mentioned this, I think, the first episode I had you on. So after the break, we'll talk about Leap into the Void from 1960.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart. But we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
And now we are going to continue our look at Eve Klein. And I didn't want to do the thing I do to my students where I just I always start my art class by talking about a work of art with students. I have them do a cold read. Mm-hmm. And you know how when the projector's on, but there's no source, it's just blue.
Yes. Yes.
I've been known to just have that on and then be like, oh, I'm sorry, that's a mistake, and then switch it to an Eve Klein blue.
That's a funny joke.
Just to see the reaction. But I think there's a little bit more to discuss with Leap into the Void from 1960. This is a photograph that he created seemingly to prove his claim of levitation. Now, as you're looking at this piece, what's jumping out at you?
Well, I mean, the fact that he's literally flying. It is a photograph of him flying. And I don't know, my favorite thing to do with it, and I guess we should describe all of it for what's for people who are not familiar. It's a street scene. There are buildings on the left side. The right side has trees, foliage, street, person riding their bike down the street. And on the left, there is, I believe, an apartment building. And Eve Klein is up on the second floor of the apartment building, literally leaping out of the window. His feet are just off the balcony. He's a good 20 feet up in the air, and his entire body is almost parallel with the street below him. He literally looks like he's flying out the window of the building. And so, my first reaction to this, my first response to this is always, how? Like, how did he do this? And, you know, that's always the question that I ask my students when I'm showing this as well. Like, how do you think he did this?
And, you know, just before we go any further, now that I've made you do the work of describing what the piece looks like, I will also point out, if you're listening on Amazon, Spotify, or anywhere else that supports episode-specific cover art, I will put this image in the cover art for this episode. But, yeah, that's also the question that I ask my students. I like to introduce photography, showing some different examples, trick photography, stuff like that, mm-hmm. You know, the standard forced perspective and all of that. With a lot of my students, one of the first things they say is green screen, you know?
Yeah. I always have, oh, Photoshop. And like, is 1960 that he made it? Yeah. Like, I don't think Photoshop was happening back then.
Yeah, and for those who don't know how he achieved this, he literally did jump off of there. The thing that's not visible in the famous image is he had friends gathered around it's not quite a net.
It's like a tarp or a trampoline almost, just basically a giant piece of cloth that's going to catch him.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you would see in like those old cartoons that I never imagined they actually had in the real world. But yeah, they were gathered around to catch him. And so what he did was he set up the camera essentially on a tripod to get a fixed position. And so he took one shot of the street with nothing there.
Yeah, just an empty street. Yeah, with the person riding the bike off to the right side. And then a second photo of him leaping. He literally did leap out of the window. They caught him, but then he used, some darkroom magic, some photography tricks to combine the leaping on the top half of the photo and the still shot of the empty street on the bottom half to make it look as though he's leaping into the void, into the empty street.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, the magic was essentially an exacto. He's just like a composite of the two shots put together. And it worked nicely. Now, this image I've seen reproduced in lots of books and stuff like that. I did not at first realize that he put this on the cover of his own newspaper. He printed up his own fake newspaper for just a single day, November 27th, 1960.
That's such an Eve Klein thing to do. You know, let me just really print my own newspaper for a day.
It really is. And, he puts up this headline that declares the painter of space leaps into the void. And he claims he won the space race and, makes all sorts of winking comments. But I think what's really telling is, as he talked about stuff, I always find it frustrating because I never know, like, what he is saying earnestly and what he is saying sort of tongue in cheek, because he talks about leaping into the void and that he is doing all this stuff. And, obviously there's a certain amount that's absurd there, but he also talked about how as an artist, he's not simply painting or representing the void. He's out there. He's becoming a part of it,
Well, and he talked about how he never wanted to use lines in his artwork because lines are constraining. He didn't want the color or the space or anything to be hemmed in. He wanted to just think about things being able to go on forever. And so, there's this weird mix there of, like earnestness and also just some weird boastful stuff that's kind of out there, and it really is. It's tough to tell the difference sometimes.
Yeah, because he would say stuff that's really sort of thought-provoking about trying to not represent but be out in there, and like you said, his talk about lines being constraining, and then he would make these absurd comments about how he hated birds because they put holes in his most beautiful artwork, the sky, and it's just like, I got to call for a timeout. Like, are you okay, dude? But in this work, I do grudgingly have to say there's something kind of beautiful about this. There's a commitment to the bit and a willingness to push it further than like anyone else was willing to go at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, that's some of the power behind his work, because he is willing to, for lack of a better term, to dive in where people, would not generally go. He's doing things that no one else is doing. He's pushing them beyond, where most artists, would generally go. And so he really is pushing the limits on what can be done with performance art, with painting, with how we talk about art even. And like you said, I think he deserves a lot of props for all of that.
Yeah. And the thing I keep coming back to as I'm looking at this, I've been thinking a lot about what we're appreciating in art. On a recent episode, I had the author of a new book, The Mona Lisa Vanishes, and we were talking about how, you know, what we see in the artwork can make it good, but it's the story that makes it great, that elevates it and gets it that sort of resonance. And as I'm looking at this, I'm wondering, do I like this photograph because of what's in the photograph? Or is this because it, to me, feels symbolic of everything that Eve Klein represented in his boundary-pushing artwork and the stories about him and the personality behind him? It's more to me, this is just like a symbol of everything that, you know, calls to mind everything I know about him.
Yeah, it's kind of the culmination of a lot of what he's been doing. And I don't know, for me, I personally like the artwork. But one thing that, you know, I've noticed over the past, I don't know, decade plus in the classroom is that, you know, when I first saw this photograph, I was like, oh my God, how did he do this? This is incredible. And now when kids see this, they, you know, there's just so many photo editing tools and so many ways to create stuff. It doesn't necessarily have that resonance with them. And they're just saying, oh, not a big deal. He could, you know, fake this, he could do whatever. And so I think for me personally, you know, it's about the photograph. I think it's very intriguing. It captures your attention. It makes you ask how. And I love that. But now when people are seeing it for the first time, I don't know that it brings up those questions as much anymore. And so maybe for people now, it might be, like you said, more representative of the entirety of his work. And the stories behind it are kind of where we focus our attention now and where we spend our time now as we talk about this piece.
Yeah, I think you're probably right in that, as always. But I guess to wrap this one up, where do you think this one belongs? Is this one for the Louvre? Is this one for the lab? Is this one for the Lou?
Oh, 100% for the Louvre for me. Not only is he French, so it belongs there. like you said, I think he was a very important artist. I think he was influential in a lot of ways, you know, whether that be just simple beauty and creating color and finding effective ways to use that beautiful color, or just conceptual stuff that was pushing the boundaries further than a lot of artists were willing to go. If we can, you know, wrap up that career into a single artwork, I think it was such an influential career that, you know, if this artwork shows that, it belongs in the Louvre.
Yeah, I would pretty much agree with that, although I, you know, always try to find a way to disagree with people.
I was going
to
say, every time I come on, you can never let me have my piece. You always need to disagree with me.
I think it's not even like a disagreement. It's more of a yes and. Because I feel like, you know, with his background, developing his own pigments and everything, it feels like there has to be a lab component there too. And
oh,
I feel like
absolutely
the intensity with which he applied himself to everything, you know, there's something to be learned from that. Even though, if I'm being 100% honest, when I look at his individual works, I feel like I don't really like a lot of them. I like his blue. It's a beautiful blue. Mm-hmm. But I also really love the idea of an artist creating their own blue. And I love the fact that, like, twice inside of a month, someone stepped on his pieces in the museum and, like, dragged the blue and left blue footprints around.
Yes. Yes.
But for me, it's like there's these stories and there are these things that we learn from with these pieces. And the physical work is just sort of it's just a cue to remind us of those stories and the lessons learned from this really intense conceptual artist who was working in so many different ways and ahead of his time in so many different ways and influential in so many ways that to me it feels like it's almost more about the learning that I do from this than the aesthetic appreciation of the piece.
Yeah, for sure. That's very well said.
Yeah. Well, thank you once again. I really appreciate your taking the time to join me once again. Tim Bogatz from Art Ed Radio. I almost said AOE Live that time, which was a real blast from the past.
I was going to say, that was, pushing a decade ago at this point. But no, thank you for the invite. I'm always happy to come on, nerd out about artistry. I love talking to you, Kyle. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.